Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Live from the campus of West Virginia State University and exclusively on the Horn, America's liberal voice, Seneca 2 proudly presents An Evening with Bar Jamal. Now, here's your moderator, Eva Knapp.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Seneca 2 Forum. I'm Eva Knapp. Seneca 2 is happy to announce this evening our new partnership with the West Virginia Citizen Action Education Fund. We're very excited about this alliance, and I would like to invite Gary Zuckett, our friend and partner, to say a few words.
Thanks, Eva. Yes, Citizen Action and Citizen Action Education Fund are very proud to be a co-sponsor of this event today. I just spent the afternoon up at the West Virginia Legislature helping bring folks from all over West Virginia down to testify about the Marcellus Shale oil and gas drilling that's going on in the boom in the state now. And so having Jamal here is very relevant to look at the legacy of oil and gas in the Gulf, because we really are right now fighting at the legislature to try to get some improved regulations for what's going on in the oil and gas fields here in West Virginia. So I thank you all for coming out tonight.
Thank you, Gary. Seneca 2 also thanks Dr. Jerry Beller and the West Virginia University Political Science Department for co-sponsoring our events. Dr. Beller, are you here? Dr. Beller indicated that he might be late this evening, and in that event that I should welcome everyone on his behalf. We're dedicating our program to the memory of Judy Bonds, whose valiant fight against the ravages of mountaintop removal are now legendary. Her words resound from our mountains. Quote, "I don't mind being poor. I mind being blasted and poisoned. There are no jobs on a dead planet." Unquote. We thank Julian Martin, her friend and longtime activist companion, for writing the tribute to her for our program tonight. Are you back there, Julian? We're delighted to have independent journalist Dar Jamal as our speaker this evening. This is Dar's second Seneca 2 Forum, and we hope there will be many more. Dar's career started in 2003 when the spurious media coverage of the Iraq War compelled him to go to the Middle East and begin his own independent news dispatches, which became read worldwide. He currently writes for many news outlets, including Interpress Service, Truth Out, and Al Jazeera. He appears on radio and television around the globe, including BBC, NPR, and Democracy Now! His many awards include the prestigious Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice, and the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage. a relentless, principled journalist, and a sterling human being. Please welcome Dar Shamil.
Well, thanks first up to Eva and Seneca too for having me out again. It's great to be with you here again in Charleston, this time talking about a different aspect of the same war that, of course, involves oil. I've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to just jump right into things here. First of all, I want to just give a brief overview of the life aspect of the Gulf of Mexico, because even though I'm from Texas, a lot of folks, including myself, didn't know of how important biologically and environmentally the Gulf of Mexico is. And so I want to start talking about aspects of it from that perspective. First of all, the Gulf of Mexico, it's the ninth largest body of water on the planet. A critical part of the Gulf being affected by the oil disaster is that the Louisiana wetlands, and these are some of the most productive ecosystems on the planet. The Gulf is also one of the most productive marine life ocean basins in the world. Half of all U.S. oysters and shrimp are from Louisiana. 98% of the shrimp, crabs, fish, and oysters harvested off the Louisiana coast depend on habitat in and around the marshes of the Barataria-Terrebonne estuary region. The Gulf is also home to dolphin, sperm whale, whale sharks, bluefin tuna, crab, hundreds of species of birds, fish, shark, and myriad other marine and coastal life. The Gulf also has 40,000 miles of pipelines and more than 50,000 oil and gas wells drilled into it. The United States currently has 2,087 offshore drilling platforms, the second most in the world, second behind Saudi Arabia. These account for 35% of all U.S. domestic oil production. Three-quarters of the total U.S. offshore rigs are deepwater rigs, meaning they're located in more than 400 meters of water. 30% of the U.S. offshore oil production is in the Gulf of Mexico, and half of these rigs are deep water rigs. One-third of these rigs are ultra deep, which means they're in 5,000 feet of depth or more, as was the Macondo well, the Deepwater Horizon rig, of which is the topic tonight. By 2020, just to give you an idea of where things are headed, offshore wells in waters of 400 meters or greater will provide an estimated 10% of total global oil. Also, for a little context of this disaster that started on April 20, just weeks before the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded on April 20, the Obama administration had just announced a large expansion of offshore drilling. And so the Deepwater Horizon disaster that started on 20 April is just one of these rigs. So first I just want to try to give you a little bit of idea of what it was like to actually go out over the area. Our first trip down to the Gulf, when me and my partner Erica, who took all the photos that we're looking at tonight, one of the first things we did is we were able to get on a flight out to the area which referred to as the source. This is the area where the Deepwater Horizon rig was before it exploded and sank to the bottom of the Gulf. And what was happening above it now that the rig was gone and directly above the wellhead that was gushing so much oil into the Gulf of Mexico, we flew out, and there was, of course, the relief well drilling rigs, many, many other ships out there, which you'll see in a moment, and then this rig directly up above where some of the oil was being siphoned off by BP. And, of course, along with that oil, a lot of the natural gases like methane, of course, which was being flamed off here off of this particular rig. But it was an amazing scene and really hard to take in, because we were flying up at about 1,500 feet, and in every direction you looked, there was oil or oil sheen on the water as far as you could possibly see. And you can see some of that in the photo here. You can kind of see the rainbow color on the surface of the water. That's clearly oil sheen. And at one point, when it was gushing, before they really got up to speed on injecting the dispersants at the wellhead, which I'll get to in a bit, we were looking at about 74,000 square miles of the surface of the Gulf of Mexico was covered with oil or oil sheen. But the scene out there was rather apocalyptic, you know, with this amount of oil on top of what normally should be a really beautiful, crystal clear blue area of the Gulf of Mexico. And instead, it looked kind of more like some sort of a war zone. And then flying back in towards the coast, this is tens of miles away from the source, and yet that kind of glassy area in the water in this picture is actually oil sheen. And it's all against the backdrop of those other things you see in the picture are wellheads or rigs. Again, when we talk about the fact that there's over 2,000 active offshore drilling platforms, it's hard to go very far, especially in this part of the Gulf of Mexico, just off the coast of Louisiana and a big portion of the coastline there, where there's just literally wellheads and rigs everywhere you go. We came a little bit closer to the coast. This is actually the Chandelier Islands, a really critical wildlife habitat, especially for pelicans and other birds. And you can kind of see here, this will be one of many photos that will display the kind of futility of the booming operations, where even oil industry insiders that I've spoken with said, you know, we do booming mostly for the media because it gives the appearance that we can actually do something to keep oil from hitting areas. But to actually do booming properly, it was explained to me that they would need booms at a minimum 5 feet high above the water, like giant barrels, because any wave action at all is just going to push stuff straight over these booms, most of which you'll see here are maximum 6 to 8 inches high. And also booms with skirts that go down about 6 feet underwater to prevent the same thing from happening underwater. But this is a pelican rookery out in the Chandelier Islands in the Chandelier Sound. And a part of that rookery, you can see here, some of the boom washed up on shore and, of course, some fresh oil coming in there. And this is really, really typical. Again, the booming that was put out, and some is still out there to this day, you know, to really properly maintain the boom and have it do its job effectively, you would need probably, I mean, for starters, at least twice as many oil cleanup crews as BP had deployed. But from the very, very beginning, it was clear that BP was not prepared to deal with a catastrophe like this. This has all come out in the media. This is not news, but some of the things that were, I think, really telling was when their initial response plan that they published actually had actions that they would take in regarding to saving the walruses and sea otters. Problem, there's no walruses or sea otters down in the Gulf of Mexico. They need to do a little more selective job of their cutting and pasting. So again, I'm going to just run through some photos here of the booming. And one reason this is such a concern is that the marsh grasses here in this area of the marsh of Louisiana is such a fragile area because the grasses literally are what keep these islands in existence. They protect it against wave action, and the islands are important as a buffer for a city like New Orleans, for example, so that it will diminish the size of hurricanes and absorb a lot of the storm surge before it hits full force into a city like New Orleans. And so when you cover a marsh area, as you can see in this photo, with oil, it's going to kill the grass. And then once the grass is gone, there's nothing to maintain the island. It basically turns into a sandbar and washes away. And so, again, you can see some really effective booming here and plenty of oil and oil sheen in this shot. And this is in the area down nearby Grand Isle, Louisiana. Again, this is what we saw. These are not fantastic pictures, meaning this is very, very common everywhere you go, even in our more recent trips down in the Gulf. This is kind of what you see as typical examples of the results of the booming. Have a couple of shots in here of BP cleanup crews, primarily to underscore that, you know, oil is classified as a hazardous material. There are plenty of toxic chemicals in it that cause all kinds of problems. It's very carcinogenic. If you were going to properly protect people according to the chemicals that are in oil, all these cleanup crews should be wearing Tyvek suits, respirators, gloves, this kind of thing. And you can see most of them have on some kind of small yellow rubber boots, but and some gloves. But beyond that, they're not protected at all. And one of the things I'll talk about a little bit later is the massive health crisis now that's affecting people along the affected areas of the Gulf. And, of course, this includes a lot of BP cleanup workers that are now intensely sick. Again, this is a bird rookery out in the nearby the Grand Isle area of Louisiana, and we can see how effective this booming operation is there. And what was, I mean, it would have been funny if there wasn't such disastrous consequences, but again, a lot of the time, it almost looked as though the boom was put up to kind of keep the oil on the marsh, as we can see here. You know, they a heavily affected marsh area with a lot of nice fresh boom then put up around it, keeping the sheen up against the marsh. This shot illustrates someone in the state of Louisiana's government apparatus's brilliant idea that they were going to basically lash barges together across one of the passes between Grand Isle and a neighboring island to try to physically form a barrier to keep the oil from washing in. Didn't quite work, also because they didn't finish the project. There were numerous almost laughable objects like this. Another one was the state of Louisiana threw a contract because someone in the government's brother ran a dredging company. They managed to get a contract literally trying to dredge up and form new islands to make as barriers to keep the island from coming in. And needless to say, that didn't have any effect either. And again, you know, the booming operation was largely for show and really didn't have much effect at all in preventing oil from going everywhere. It ended up going anyhow. And again, in pictures like this, you can see that there's a kind of a smooth area of the water there in the center of the picture. That's all oil sheen. And I want to run through, this is a time frame of photos from basically the early August onwards. And at this point, we're looking at, you know, Obama had just gone down to the Gulf in early August to do a photo op off on the, supposedly, he claimed, his administration claimed it was on the coast of Florida. It was actually not on the coast. It was actually on a back bay. He's in the water with his daughter. There's this famous photo of them smiling, declaring the Gulf is open for business. Seafood is safe to eat. Tourism's open for business. Come on down. The problem was that things, you know, they had just capped the well just before that. And the problem was that the disaster was really just beginning, and it still is today. And this beach in this photo, this is the beach at Grand Isle. It's right nearby the state park. It's actually closed as we speak because there's so much oil, tar mats and tar balls and dead wildlife washing up on a daily basis that it's literally closed right now. They have deep beach cleaning activities going on, dredging up sand and running it through machinery trying to clean it, but more stuff keeps coming in. And I'll get back to why that's happening in a little bit. But this beach at the time, this is August 16th, was actually open because, and there were families there, you can see here in the photo, literally playing in the surf that when I walked right out to the water right there, you could see the tar balls coming in underwater, rolling across the bottom. But people, families are out there playing and having a vacation because this local, state, and federal governments, including Barack Obama himself, had declared everything was just fine. Come on back to the Gulf. Everything's great. Grand Isle is in Louisiana. It's one of the southernmost points of Louisiana, and it's been one of the most heavily affected and first affected areas by this. So we chose this date, August 16, to go out on a boat looking at some of these fisheries because they had just reopened a lot of these fishing areas, declaring them safe and all the seafood safe for consumption. And so we decided we would go out and see what folks were catching, if anything, because one thing, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but the massive amount of dispersants that BP used to sink and hide the oil, 1.9 million gallons of toxic dispersants, which are basically an industrial solvent that dissolves the oil, breaks it up into small droplets, and then it sinks it. There was an EPA study done about 20 years that actually showed 50% of the shrimp that were exposed to a small amount of dispersants died immediately upon contact, and then most of the rest of the shrimp exposed die within 48 hours. And so we're going out of Fouchon, Louisiana, basically on one of the ends of Grand Isle, and we run into this fisherman, the shrimper, coming in, and we said, "How'd you do?" And he said, "I did not catch one shrimp." And we said, our charter captain who took us out asked him, "Well, how much do you usually catch?" And he said, "Between 300 and 500 pounds." And so not one single shrimp. And then just after this fellow, we run into another very similar boat, and we asked him, "How'd you do?" And he said, "I caught 12 shrimp, as in one dozen shrimp, when normally they would go out and haul in, fill all those coolers, catch several hundred pounds of shrimp at a go. And we went out into the area where that had just been open for shrimping, for white shrimp, and this is what we saw. You know, lots of boom. You can, you know, all that should be clear yellow and clear white boom. Of course, there's oil dripping off of it. There were private contractor cleanup boats out there with boom. We weren't really sure exactly what they were doing because all the islands we went and visited, this is what we found. There at some point had been cleanup operations. There was boom. But more often than not, it would be washed up on shore like this. Meanwhile, the islands we visited, you walked on them, and you would find oil-soaked oyster beds like this, boom like this that had clearly been there for a long time. That dark brown boom is sorbent boom that only absorbs oil, nothing else. But that means it has to be picked up. There were operations, they would pick them up, take them back in, you could clean them and then put them back out, but clearly this wasn't happening. And so you walk across these oils, these islands, and you can see the rainbow color of the sheen amongst the dead marsh grass there, and they were so covered and soaked in oil that literally you could, I would step on the sand and oil and sheen would come up out of the sand, and the whole island smelled like a gas station. And again, many areas that were covered in this old boom. This is PVC pipe, which is put up to actually hold sorbent boom in place. And you can see a little bit of the sorbent boom still there on the right side. But again, most of the rest of it, you can see some of the other sorbent boom washed up on the marsh there, just not getting the job done. And then, of course, the PVC pipe is there. Nobody's come to pick it up, and obviously that stuff's not going to exactly biodegrade. And of course, in the background we have drilling platforms. I'm sorry. I'll take questions and answers at the end of my talk. It's vertical. This is a photo of a tar mat. There's now, even as we speak, many, many of the barrier islands off Louisiana that are, the beaches of them are just covered with, in some areas, acres of tar mats that range anywhere from half an inch thick to 6 to 8 inches thick. Another area we came to, some of these inland lagoons in this one barrier island, where you can really see here, these are fiddler crabs kind of on top of an oil sheen covered sandy area right up against water that is covered with this kind of brownish, nasty dispersed oil and oil sheen. So this picture really displays, you know, what's happening to marine life. You know, crabs, shrimp, fish, etc. They're filtering all this water through their bodies. And this is just looking a little further out in that same body of water, just really, really thick oil sheen. The chemicals coming off this stuff, so intense, literally burning your eyes, causing you to cough, giving you a headache, making you a bit lightheaded. This was happening to us as we hiked further into this island. This is another inland lagoon in this same area. Again, here you can see brown, literally brown oil bubbling up in the heat on top of the water, surrounded by a sorbent boom, basically just holding it in against these different marsh areas. In some areas like this, literally just thick, black, pure crude oil mixed in with the mud. You can see some there that we walked through. And again, you can see the marsh there. That's about a foot up the marsh of just, it's just coated in black oil from when the tide rises and falls. And then we walk back out to the boat and get in the boat, and this is against the backdrop again of these drilling platforms out there. And that particular day, we covered about 40 nautical miles of Gulf. A lot of our boat travel was out in the Gulf, not inside of Barrier Island. And the entire day, we were literally in sheen the entire time. Dispersants. So the dispersants used are called, the two that BP used, they're called Corexit 9500 and Corexit 9527. And like I said, these are basically industrial solvents. Some of the chemicals in them, many of the chemicals in them are mutagenic, teratogenic, and carcinogenic. And these are dispersants that are banned actually in at least 19 other countries, including the UK. And they started using them very shortly after it became clear to them how much oil was gushing out of the well and how much was coming to the surface and how bad of press this was creating for BP. Because BP, under the EPA, under environmental law, when there's a disaster like this, every amount of oil that they end up deciding this is what came out of that well, they're going to be fined for that. And so what BP decided to do was use 1.9 million gallons of dispersant, aerial spraying from C-130s run by the Coast Guard, but then also they went down to the wellhead and injected at least one-third of the total amount directly into the wellhead at 5,000 feet. So to date, 90% of the oil has never come up to the surface. And so to give you an idea, most of you are here tonight, you've read about this, you've read the news, you've heard about the oil plumes. To give you an idea how this works, I actually got my hands on some pure Corexit 9500. And I gave it to a lab analyst, and he did this little experiment that we can see here in the photo. He basically got some seawater and put some seawater in each vial and a little bit of oil in each vial, and then added just a, not even a drop, just a tiny speck of Corexit into the sample on the left, shook it for about 30 seconds because that's what happens in the Gulf, and then let it sit there, and there you have it. It dispersed the oil, it broke it up, it sent it down into the water column and created this kind of cloud. He said 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, it looked exactly the same way. And that's why we have scientists from University of South Florida and University of Georgia, especially Dr. Samantha Joy from University of Georgia, maybe you've seen her in the news, who've been studying, following, logging, photographing these oil plumes. Some of them are a half a mile thick and 22 miles long, just giant kind of nasty dispersed clouds of dissolved, dispersed. It doesn't remove the oil, it just breaks it down into tiny, tiny little bits and then they still all kind of pull together and they go around in the Gulf. But it accomplished the job that BP wanted to do, which is out of sight, out of mind. If it doesn't come up to the top, you can't tabulate exactly how much oil there is, and so it's going to mean less fines overall, and it's going to be not as bad media when you can't see these giant swaths of black oil floating on the top of the Gulf. And so this is a telling experiment also, because if you look at the top part of that vial on the left, you see this kind of white foamy substance, and that is what you see in the wake of when they spray the dispersants onto the oil. And there's still spraying going on as we speak, despite the fact that BP and the Coast Guard claims that the last time any was sprayed was July 19th, and it's a flat-out lie. And so they spray this stuff. Here is on the Long Beach, right on the coast of Mississippi. Some of this kind of nasty whitish foam, you can smell it. And we actually, you can see me there taking a sample of this stuff, had this tested, and it absolutely has chemicals from the Corexit dispersants in it, and of course oil, some of the chemicals of oil in it. And this is right up against the beach area there. And you see this stuff all over out there. After they spray it, comes washing ashore in Mississippi. It's still happening to this day. This is I'll come back to that to mention something else in a minute, but this is these are photos of a flight we took when we had a whole bunch of weathered oil come up to the mouth of the Mississippi, right where it dumps in to the Gulf of Mexico, again down there just south of Venice, Louisiana, kind of more on the southeastern part of the southernmost part of the state. And you can see these kind of lines of weathered oil all across this area, which of course was already also had long since been opened to fishing. And we have a shrimp boat there trawling through literally this weathered oil. And a colleague of mine, Rocky Kinsler, he's actually a journalist who works for the NRDC, and he went out boat like this and watched them and photographed them catching some shrimp, and they did catch some white shrimp. The problem was a whole lot of the shrimp literally had, you could see, and I've seen his photos, have black oil in their gills. They're pulling in these shrimp. This actually was when we were out on the boat trip I was talking about earlier on August 16. So this is out basically to the southwest area of Grand Isle, Louisiana. And we had come across an area that was freshly of oil that was freshly sprayed with Corexit. So the thick black or brown oil on the top, it will sink that oil, but there's always going to be this kind of residual, nasty, chemical white foam, pasty stuff on the surface. And again, me and the fellow I was with, Jonathan Henderson with the Gulf Restoration Network, used two separate labs to test this stuff and came up with the same results. Again, it's dispersed oil and Corexit chemicals. So what we've seen by the end of the summer, massive crab kills, fish kills, and sometimes even bird kills in parts of Louisiana, parts of Mississippi, and parts of Alabama, and even parts of western Florida had become common. So then we have to talk about seafood. The problem is the U.S. government has been very, very active in trying to convince everybody that the Gulf's fine, this disaster has been handled, it's okay to eat the seafood, it's okay to come back and come to the Gulf as a tourist. The problem is up until the middle of October, they had one test in place for seafood, for oil chemicals. They didn't have anything at that point yet to try to even test for dispersants. And the test was literally a sniff test, where they had seven people in a room, and they would give each of them a piece of fish, for example. And if five of the seven couldn't smell chemicals, then that batch of fish was considered safe for consumption and entered into the market. Now, I'm not making this up. This was literally the one test the federal government had to test for seafood from April 20, when this thing started, to the middle of October. That was the one test. they at that point then, under a lot of fire, implemented a new test as an augment to that, saying, okay, now we're happy to announce we've introduced a new test for dispersants. So they put out these thresholds for certain chemicals in the dispersants and said if shellfish test below 500 parts per million, then they're safe for consumption. And if finfish test for below 100 parts per million of these chemicals, then they're safe for consumption. And the first thing I did is I contacted Hugh Kaufman. He's a senior policy analyst for the EPA. He's a whistleblower. He broke Love Canal. He broke the facts about the toxics being present in Ground Zero in the aftermath of 9/11, and when all the rescue responders started getting really, really sick and many of them eventually started dying. He's the guy that actually blew the whistle on his own EPA, saying this is not safe, this is extremely toxic, and people are going to die because of this. So I sent this press release of this new dispersant test that was released by the Food and Drug Administration and NOAA to Hugh Kaufman, and he basically wrote me back and said, I'd love to talk to you about this. And so he basically laughed at the test, saying this is an absolute joke. They're not even saying that they're doing this for people to be safe, that the goal of their new testing is to convince people that things are okay. And more importantly, I talked with a chemist named Bob Naiman out of Mobile Bay, Alabama, who has been testing seafood samples independently for dispersant and oil chemicals from the very beginning of this disaster. And he said, look, these levels that, first of all, they say are acceptable. So by their own definition, 499 parts per million of these chemicals being present in a shrimp or a crab or other shellfish is okay. He said, if I had a shrimp with 499 parts per million of any chemical in it, I'd be able to literally like wring that chemical out of the shrimp. But they're saying that's safe for human consumption. And then he basically said the same thing for the level 100 parts per million for finfish. But the most telling thing is he said, their whole thing is saying they're testing for dispersant chemicals, and that they admit in their press release, I think they tested roughly 1,350 samples and found about 8% of them to have levels below, of course, their acceptable levels, but they admitted that about 8% of them had some traces of the chemicals. But what Bob Naiman, the chemist, said the problem was with that is that the test for dispersants, you have to test in parts per billion, not parts per million. And yet, by their own admission, they're still finding samples in the parts per millions. And he said that's actually, for these chemicals that we have to look for, is astronomically high. And they've right there admitted it in their own press release. I've talked to fishermen who've gone out and said, look, we're desperate. We are hauling in shrimp out of water, covered in sheen, and introducing it in the market, and not any of it has been caught, flagged, and said, this is not safe for human consumption. I've talked to guys who've admitted that to me in public, openly. We are consciously introducing seafood into the market that is contaminated. Nevertheless, the fishing industry is suffering. Like I mentioned earlier, shrimp catches are way down, in some places non-existent. Same in fish populations. And this is already happening very quickly because when we compare it, for example, to the Eekstock well blowout in the Bay of Campeche in the far western area of the Gulf of Mexico in 1979, to this day, for example, this is a disaster that dwarfs in comparison size-wise to the BP disaster, but to this day, it left their shrimp populations wiped out for the next 4 years, and for a lot of the other different fish species that were affected, it took them between 15 to 20 years to come all the way back. The same thing can be said that happened in the wake of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster up in Valdez, Alaska. But we're already, this disaster was so big by comparison, we're already seeing problems of a lot of the seafood distributors are suffering. A lot of the fish houses are already in bankruptcy. I've been talking to people about that very recently, saying, look, my home is in foreclosure. My business is basically sinking. I haven't made a dime since May. And so they're suffering. Meanwhile, there still is, you know, a little bit of fishing and shrimping going on. This stuff's, interestingly here, this is at Dean Blanchard Seafood Company down in Grand Isle, Louisiana. And he's still running, and this is a shrimp boat bringing in a load of shrimp. And yet the problem is most of the shrimpers and the seafood distributors I'm talking with down there is saying, I wouldn't eat any of this stuff if you forced me to. For example, this is James Catfish Miller. He is a third-generation fisherman from Mississippi. And he's holding this sign because, as he explained to me, he was going to meetings with the governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, with BP officials as they held meetings along the coast, saying, look, you guys can't be pushing so fast to open this back up. We're the ones whose livelihoods depend on this stuff being safe, the stuff being the seafood. And if you guys push for this to open up and people start getting sick, it's game over for us. So, interestingly and ironically, the people who have the most to lose from this, the fishermen themselves, are the ones fighting the hardest against the government to get them to slow the hell down from opening things back up, because they understand what's at stake. They wouldn't listen to these guys. This is Mark Stewart. He's a friend of James Miller's. And so what these guys decided to do is they said, look, this is out in the Mississippi Sound, and they said, we know that there's oil. There's basically plumes of oil even in the Mississippi Sound. And so they started taking out scientists and journalists on their shrimp boat to prove it. And so here we are out on their shrimp boat. This is off the coast of Mississippi, but still within the barrier islands. And this whole Mississippi Sound area is actually full of undersea dispersed oil. And they said, all right, people don't believe us. We're going to prove it. So they took a grappling hook, and they took this sorbent cloth, made basically the same stuff the sorbent boom is made out of. It will hold oil, but nothing else. They tied this sorbent cloth to a grappling hook, put it underwater, making sure they kept it off the bottom. They have a depth finder. They know exactly what depth to put it at. They held it there for about 30 seconds, and then they pull it up, and lo and behold, it's full of dispersed oil. We ran some samples in a lab, had it tested, you know, dispersants, oil chemicals, all there, very high levels. Enough is there that you can literally see it with the naked eye. And these guys took out, Cousteau's nephew was down there, other scientists, other journalists, showing them this. Look, you know, you can't open this area for fishing, but that's exactly what the government, Haley Barbour, both the state, local, and federal governments have done. All these areas now are back open for open fishing, recreational and commercial fishing and shrimping. And so another thing these guys did is, this is a contraption that Mark put together. He called it the whale. He basically took some tomato cages that you would put around tomatoes in your garden and fill them up with some of this sorbent pad, taped it up, held it under the water for a bit, pull it up, there you have it, full of dispersed oil. Meanwhile, back in New Orleans, this is a picture at a Whole Foods market of fresh Gulf white shrimp for sale. And then this leads us to the health crisis along the Gulf of Mexico. One thing I want to mention before I get to the health crisis is to read just briefly some of the problems with these dispersants, because the dispersants coupled with the chemicals in the oil itself, when you mix them together, it actually creates a more toxic compound. And let me just read you some of the symptoms that people are experiencing. First of all, the pathways of exposure to the dispersants and the chemicals in them are inhalation from the air, because they're off-gassing off the surface of the Gulf, ingestion, as in drinking contaminated water, groundwater, or eating seafood, skin and eye contact. Health impacts include headaches, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pains, dizziness, chest pains and tightness, irritation of eyes, nose, throat, and lungs, difficulty breathing, respiratory system damage, skin irritation and sensitization, hypertension, central nervous system depression, neurotoxic effects, genetic damaging mutations. Like I mentioned earlier, they're mutagenic, teratogenic, and carcinogenic. Cardiac arrhythmia, cardiovascular damage, seizures, and several others. That's the short list. They're also, needless to say, these chemicals are disastrous to phytoplankton, zooplankton, fish, shrimp, and crab larvae, which of course form the entire basis of the marine food chain. And so the problem is, as Dr. Ricky Yod, a toxicologist, has described to me, that dispersants now, looking at them from a health perspective, basically act like a delivery system for oil. They're basically a delivery vehicle of oil. They break it up. They make it much easier for these chemicals to get into people's bodies. And what's amazing is when you see oil, crude oil, that's actually been hit with dispersants, it actually turns it a kind of lightish brown and makes it kind of this kind of soft rubbery. That's exactly what we're looking at right there. There's a little kid's footprint right up against some dispersed kind of a small tar ball of dispersed oil. This is on the beach of Orange Beach, Alabama. Meanwhile, again, beaches are all open because Obama said so, because BP said so, state and local government said so. So we literally have people out there swimming. Even back when the wellhead was still gushing oil, and we have boom literally off the coast, but folks down there playing on the beach. So health problems. James Miller, who I was just talking about, went out in a boat with his wife just to go see what was going on in the Mississippi Sound. This is about a month or so ago. They went into an area, as he described, of dispersed oil. They saw all the foam on the surface. All of them got sick immediately. They started gagging, feeling faint. Came back home. The next day, he's taking a shower. He passes out cold in the shower. His wife has to take him to Biloxi Regional Hospital, and he has since had his blood tested and has extremely high levels of dispersants and crude oil chemicals in his blood. This is Denise Rednar. She lives in Long Beach, Mississippi. She didn't work in the oil cleanup or anything like this. She's just simply the average coastal resident down there, lives a few miles from the coast. She is now suffering. She has a massive internal bleeding. As she described to me, she's literally bleeding from every orifice, lives with constant headaches, other problems like this. She recently had her blood tested independently. It's $300 to get your blood tested with what's called a Metamatrix blood test. Her chemical levels are extremely high. This is Karen Hopkins. She is Dean Blanchard's secretary. Again, we're back down in Grand Isle, Louisiana now. This is one of the biggest seafood distributors in Louisiana. Very, very well known. She's his secretary, basically the brains of the operation. And she told me personally, straight up, tell it to the media. And I said, look, I'm reporting for Al Jazeera. We have 220 million viewers. She said, great, tell them that I would never, ever eat another piece of seafood that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. I hate to say that, but it's true. This is Shirley Tillman. She is from Past Christiane, Mississippi. Her and her husband, Don, just had their blood tested. They were in BP cleanup workers. They have toxic chemicals, literally oil and dispersants in their veins. Her grandson, a three-year-old child by the name Gavin, has been to the doctor. What did she tell me? I talked to her just earlier today. 17 times in the last 60 days, he's been on 7 rounds of major antibiotics and is extremely sick. He just had his blood tested. He has oil and dispersants in his blood. The problem is, as Dr. Ricky Yacht had described to me, we're looking at an area from Terrebonne Parish, Louisiana, over to the Big Bend area of Florida and 20 to 30 miles inland. We're talking about between 4 and 5 million Americans now down on the Gulf that are being exposed on a fairly regular basis to these types of chemicals. Donnie and Angel Matzler, they're from Dauphin Island, Alabama. Donnie was helped do a little of the oil cleanup himself. He's so sick, he's passing out, vomiting, foam, brown foam, he said, extremely sick with chemicals. He, too, had his blood tested, extremely high levels of the chemicals in his blood. I actually caught up with them in a clinic in Dallas, Texas. This is Dr. William Ray. Set up his clinic in the wake of the Exxon Valdez disaster to treat cleanup workers from that one. And he said, yep, he basically told Donnie that he was Corexit drunk, that he had so many chemicals from the Corexit in his body that it was literally affecting his thinking and these sorts of things. And so proper treatment means first you get people away from being exposed, meaning away from the coast, and then he talks about full diet change, doing intravenous flushes of washes, this kind of thing, hot saunas to try to flush these chemicals out of people's bodies, very strict regimes that take months. But then the problem is they're going to go back down to the Gulf where they're going to keep getting exposed to this stuff. There's still, as we speak, fresh oil coming up, plumes washing ashore. There's still spraying going on right up next to the shore. They're actually using boats now to spray smaller areas up to shore as this stuff keeps washing in. So it's an ongoing problem. So as a result, a little bit of a silver lining to this dark cloud is that bands of fishermen, offshore oil workers, and residents along the Gulf and activists from across the entire political spectrum are coming together and seeing this common problem that, look, we live in this basically corporatocracy where we have this melding of a company like BP and the government, and they're fighting back, and they're trying to demand their state, local, and federal government officials to stop allowing Corexit to be used, to come down and start doing real testing of the air, of the soil, and of the water, and of the seafood, and also of humans. This is a fisherman demonstration in Biloxi Harbor, Mississippi. All these guys, again, we see James Miller on the right. These other two folks are fisher folks also. And they're banding together and basically trying to fight back and get some positive change going for themselves. This is at a demonstration at the capital of Louisiana, the state capital in Baton Rouge. Again, a lot of fishermen coming together, trying to protest, trying to get their state officials to do the right thing and help them out. This is Sherry Foytlin. She is involved, very involved in one of these groups who's trying to keep attention on what's going on down there and cause a little bit of positive change. But, you know, this is such a crisis of monumental proportions, and the thing that I really want to stress is that we're at the very, very beginning of this. It's been less than a year since this thing started, and we are just now at a point where we're just now starting to see health effects from this. Another call that I received from down in the Gulf today was of a young man, a 22-year-old guy, young, healthy, in shape. Apparently this was a guy getting ready to join the Marine Corps, lives in Western Florida, went swimming in the Gulf back in August. Since that time has been horrifically sick. He's averaging between 3 and 5 seizures a day. Recently in Louisiana, he was at a forum. He had his blood tested, just got his results back today. The doctor that tested his blood and did the analysis said, basically, you should be dead. I don't see how you're alive. You're probably only alive because you were 22 and healthy when this whole thing started. And now his family's trying to figure out, how do we get enough money to get our son up to Johns Hopkins, which is apparently where they decided he needs to go to actually get some treatment for this. So I think that as we go forward from here, we're looking at not even talking about the ecological impact, which is obviously going to be huge, but the human impact of this disaster. We're just now starting to see how severe this is going to be, and it's the very beginning. We also have to consider that when oil settles in the mud of a lagoon, like a lot of the photos that I showed you tonight in the marsh area, that it's going to stay there for decades. You can't get it out. It's going to stay there for decades and continue to degrade the environment. We also, and this is tied into a lot of the stuff that you have to face in West Virginia, talking about fracking, talking about the coal mining. And as dwindling reserves of oil and these resources continue to dwindle, we're going to be looking at drilling, as I kind of alluded to at the very beginning of the talk, that it's pushing drilling further and further offshore. So we've already hit the areas and sucked them dry where the oil was easiest and cheapest to get. So we are seeing this push driven by our consumption of oil, of pushing them into these deep water wells and now even ultra deep water wells. For example, the deepest well in the Gulf of Mexico currently being accessed is at about 10,000 feet, and it's being run by BP. And that's been ongoing. So basically, we need to consider the fact that given that U.S. citizens use roughly 20 million barrels of oil per day, and the fact that less than a month after the BP's Macondo well was actually capped, yet was still a long ways from being cemented, the Senate adjourned for the summer without taking up a new energy bill. I think that we all understand what we're up against. If you're here tonight, you're concerned about this. You're concerned about what's going on in West Virginia. And I just hope that this is enough information to show that, you know, we're basically all involved in the same fight, and that all that's at stake is basically, you know, the life on the planet and our health and the ecology that we live in. And so I think we are at a crisis point, but I think that awareness is great enough. It's a matter of each one of us deciding what can I do? What can I do to take responsibility for this? And I think there's immediate, I know that there's immediate things that we can all do to start getting ourselves off oil, and then start working within our communities to figure out how we can broaden that out into a local, state, and federal level to do what absolutely has to be done at this point to address this growing crisis. And I know you here in Charleston are aware of this probably more so than folks in most other communities in the country. So, you know, folks in the Gulf understand that. Folks in the Gulf understand that it's all the same war that we're fighting, whether it's in West Virginia or Mississippi or Alabama, and we're all in this together and we have to fight together. And I know that they've now dedicated their lives to tackling this problem and getting involved. And so I hope you'll consider doing the same thing. And thanks all y'all for coming out tonight. We have an audience mic. Million. The dispersants are definitely chemically more dangerous than the oil itself, but there have been studies done that show that when you actually then mix the oil and the dispersants, it creates a substance that's actually 4 to 10 times more hazardous than either of those.
There you go. I was wondering if, in your very subjective opinion, it has to be subjective, things would seem to you to be much different as they happened, as they would have been in the last administration. I mean, you know, for the last couple of years, we've been hoping that Mr. Obama was going to be different. And your description here, your horrendous description of what's going on, with Obama in the White House, and having been there for some months, so he presumably was not just a new guy, doesn't make one confident that either political party is going to be much help.
I think that's precisely accurate. And again, taking my opinion and subjectivity out of it, if we simply look at what Barack Obama has done, whether we talk about Iraq or Afghanistan or corporate power or Wall Street or, you know, any of these issues, these huge issues, he's been at least as bad as the previous administration, if not worse. And I think when we look at what he's done with BP, I mean, the complicity of, just for example, let's talk, I haven't talked about it at all, Ken Feinberg, the guy that was appointed to administer the $20 billion so-called compensation fund. This was a guy who was independently appointed as an independent fund manager by Barack Obama to dispense this massive amount of compensation money to people whose livelihoods along the Gulf have been destroyed, individuals and businesses. Ken Feinberg. So this is a guy who is being paid, it was revealed, $850,000 a month by BP. And yet, to this day, the Obama administration, until 2 weeks ago, when a federal court in New Orleans forced Feinberg to admit, no, I am actually working for BP, and this is how much my firm, Feinberg Rosen, has been paid, was continuing to claim that. And so this whole farce of, well, the government's going to force BP to do the right thing. I mean, we have a federal law. It's called the Oil Spill Pollution Act of 1990, that under federal law, the government has the power to literally engage Department of Homeland Security and the Coast Guard to actually force BP to do the right thing, to do the right compensations that have to be happening. It's federal law. That could be enforced. Why is that not being enforced? I mean, I could go down a litany of examples showing that instead of a government actually acting in the interest of taking care of its citizens, is of course acting instead totally in the interest of BP. Would not the EPA or NOAA or the Coast Guard be under the charge of Barack Obama, and him being able to say, you're going to force them to stop using these chemicals that are banned in 19 other countries in our Gulf of Mexico because they're going to affect our people. And instead of doing that, they've given them a green light to do whatever they want to do. And it's really, I think that's one of the things that's been made most evident by this whole disaster, is that this government, the government before it, whatever, they're basically just rolling down tracks that are laid out by corporate power. They don't really have much say in what's going to happen about that. And I would argue that confidently that, I would just question how much power really does the President of the United States have at this point.
Thanks. From the health effects that you described and the findings with the blood tests and so forth, it just seems to me that do you know if there are people working now to organize lawsuits for those damages, for those health impacts?
Yeah. I can't disclose too much because a lot of the lawsuits, there's a lot of deep investigative work being done to build data, to build scientific proof, and this takes time. But, yeah, there's some very serious lawsuits with some very big players in the works, which is good news. The bad news is, along those same lines, is that BP's taking a page out of Exxon's playbook. We have to just look at Valdez in 89 when Exxon literally just litigated people to death. And I mean literally, like litigated to where a huge number of the cleanup workers literally had already died from the same types of dispersants used then that were used now. On down to the point where what the final settlement was whittled down from $5 billion down to $500 million, I think. And BP is basically trying to do the same thing. They'll try to litigate and stretch this out as long as they can. But fortunately, lessons have been learned. And, for example, the lawsuit that was just concluded in New Orleans 2 weeks ago that I mentioned, that's basically laying some groundwork against Feinberg and this bogus compensation process, and is actually already that in itself already opened up the compensation claims that have already been denied. That just reopened all those entire claims up. So definitely there's some serious litigation coming down the pike.
I had a question about the health effects that are in the air. How far inland is that going? Like, is it as far as Baton Rouge, or is it that far or just very close to the coast?
Yeah, good question. Scientific studies have been done on the types of chemicals in the dispersants in oil that then evaporate up into the clouds. How far can they travel? And one study I know for sure puts that at around 20 miles. As long as they don't run into a tree or something, they can go 20 miles before that's as far as they can travel. However, I don't understand how this happened, but I interviewed a seafood distributor named C.J. Troxley, who lives 100 miles as the crow flies from the coast of Louisiana. And to date, he has some of the highest levels of chemicals in his blood. Now, is that because he's not so far from Lake Pontchartrain and somehow a lot of these chemicals got into Lake Ponch? We don't know. And this is a guy, he wasn't in the cleanup. He avoided it. He only went down to Grand Isle a couple times to visit friends while all this has been going on. And yet, for some reason, he has such high chemicals in his blood, he's actually already moved away from the coast and now lives in Seattle. And all these people I've spoken with, and I've talked to several people now who have literally left, that they got their blood tested, they've talked to doctors, and they understand, if I don't get out of here and stop being exposed to this stuff, I'm in big trouble. And everyone, when they leave, they immediately start feeling better, and then the second they come back, they start feeling worse again. Donnie and Angel Masler, I showed their photos, that's exactly what happened to them. They went up to Dallas, they spent a few weeks getting treated by Dr. Ray, and then the second they went back to Dolphin Island, they started spiraling out again. So it's a very, very serious thing. And I interviewed Dr. Ricky Ott. Some of you may have heard of her. She was a fisher person up in Cordova, Alaska, when Valdez happened. And she's a toxicologist and a marine biologist. And I interviewed her early on in our first trip back in June. And she said, if we had a government that was really dealing with this the way we're talking about, acute toxic chemical exposure to a massive civilian population in this area, and if we had a government that was really going to deal with it the way it should properly be dealt with from a toxicological perspective, the government would actually force BP to cover the cost to relocate all those people away from the coast until enough studies could be done over enough time to actually show it was actually still safe to live there. And again, compare that response to the response we got. No, the question is, wasn't there a plan in place to actually relocate people? And I've never seen anything from a local, state, or federal government that was involved. Maybe there were. I know of one NGO in Seattle that helped relocate Troxley that I mentioned, a tiny little group of people that I think has maybe managed to raise enough funds to relocate two people. But I know of no government on any level plan to relocate people.
Two questions real quick. One, this is obviously a horrifying story, and it's a story of a human rights crisis. What are the local media doing down in the region to cover it? Is there any meaningful coverage? Is there any generation of outrage? And second, what does it take to get, an Anderson Cooper to parachute back in and give a darn again? And secondly, and wholly separate, is there any way to trace the secondary effects of these toxins, these poisons, as these toxified seafood go into the stream of commerce and wind up on plates in, you know, Minnesota and the St. Louis and here?
Mm-hmm. Local coverage, there has been some really good local coverage that I've seen when I've been down there. The Times-Picayune in New Orleans has done some good stories. I've seen some really good local TV coverage from small little local TV stations that have actually gone out and reported on sick people. Done a story on some of these. There's a couple of really good doctors down there that are addressing the acute toxicity, the human health crisis. And I've seen some really good local reportage. It's been spotty. It's been infrequent. But there has been, to their credit, some decent local coverage down there on the coast. I even saw a local Fox affiliate do a good piece on Donnie Matzler that I showed you his picture here tonight and showed specifically what happened to this guy, the skin rashes he was dealing with from the chemicals, etc. But that has been infrequent and uncommon, and but it has happened. And then what would it take to get national media back down there? I don't know, because one of the guys that's been really helpful with getting me out into boats and planes that I mentioned, Jonathan Henderson, earlier, with a group called the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. And last time we were down there, I said, Jonathan, well, what kind of media are you seeing? Because their phone rings off the hook. People know, contact these guys. They can get you up to speed on what's going on. And he said, it's pretty much international media now, that we have far more big international outlets, newspapers, magazines, TV, coming down to the coast, that we're taking them out in boats and doing follow-up stories, etc. And pretty much most of the U.S. national media, is not here. Every once in a while, someone will parachute in and do a spot or something, but they've pretty much, once Obama did that move going down to the Florida coast area in August, that pretty much most of the media took that and said, all right, we're all good here. We'll see you later. As far as tracing those chemicals in seafood, what it would take is having enough funding to get some independent labs with the capabilities of doing these testings and basically have a massive amount of independent testing of the seafood. There is some of that going on down in the coast. I've written about it, and Bob Naiman, who I mentioned, he's a chemist in Alabama, he's doing it. Dr. Wilma Subra, she's a MacArthur Fellow chemist in New Iberia, Louisiana, she's doing it. And these results are being posted and sent out. Louisiana Environmental Action Network, LEAN, they're regularly posting these results. But we're talking about, because it takes a lot of money to do this kind of testing, and we're talking about a lot of it being self-funded, so a small number of pieces of seafood that are being tested. But of all those being tested, like by Bob Naiman, the chemist in Alabama, he said every single piece of seafood that I've been brought that I've tested has had extremely high levels of these chemicals. And the problem is, what we need is a responsible federal government that would kick in the FDA and the EPA and NOAA to start doing the testing that they are supposed to be doing. And instead, like I mentioned, it's just not happening, or we have these kind of like small, tiny little amounts of this bogus testing instead that's not really testing at all.
Near the end of your presentation, you spoke about people who live along the Gulf going to their local officials and state officials, Louisiana, presumably Louisiana, Mississippi, maybe Florida, and lobbying for to be effective in responding to the really cataclysmic situation. How do they feel? Do they think that they're really getting a response? I mean, last summer when this whole issue began to phase down in the national media, it seemed as though the local, the local political establishments, the state legislatures and the governors, were getting a better response. Now, of course, this is the way it comes to us. It may not have been the case at all. But at that time, it seemed as though the local officials were getting a better press out of it than certainly the Obama administration was. I mean, certainly Governor Jindal was. Is that still holding up? Do you feel that that people are satisfied with the response of the local officials and the local and the state officials down there?
No, that's a good question. And for the most part, the people are not being heard, and they're very angry about that. But that said, there have been a couple of exceptions. I can't remember one of the Louisiana senators has actually taken the dispersants issue up in a very big way, and has actually been doing everything he can, to his credit, to address it, to try to force the Obama administration to do something about this, to do the testing, to stop the continued use of the dispersants, etc. But that guy aside, and then one of the Florida senators has had a really positive response to people's concerns as well. But those two exceptions aside, every other state and local and federal official that's been approached on this has basically ignored it. And just to give you an idea, I mean, that just gives me, Eve and I were talking about this earlier, and To give you an idea of how in cahoots, how much BP's running this whole show, and how much power they have versus how much power the government really has, I did a story on the EPA, and I wanted to find out, why are you not doing more testing? And, for example, there's an activist I know named Michelle Nix from Pensacola, Florida, and there was a meeting in November in Pensacola where Lisa Jackson, the head of the EPA, was there to talk to people. And Michelle Nix walked up to her after the meeting and very politely handed her a packet of paperwork and said, these are the actual blood analysis results of all these people that we've tested and they're sick. I want you to look at this and I want you to get back to me. Here's the contact of Dr. Wilma Subra, a MacArthur fellow who did the analysis. Will you contact me or Dr. Subra and let us know what you're going to do about this? To this day, she never heard back from her. So a couple of months after that, I call the EPA in Washington, D.C. I call Lisa Jackson's office, and I said, hi, I'm a journalist with Al Jazeera, 220 million viewers. We're doing a story on the EPA response to the Gulf. I know of this incident where Lisa Jackson was personally handed this analysis to these blood tests. And the person I spoke with there at their main office said, we can't talk to you about that. You actually need to call the Central Command Response Office for the Gulf oil spill disaster, and they'll help you with that. And so I called the number she gives me, and it's a phone operator in Houston at a center that's actually run by BP. And so that gives you an idea of how this is working. And I've done other stories where I tried to contact regional offices of the EPA, one in Dallas, one in Louisiana, in the same thing. Everything's routed through the call center in Houston that's being run by BP. So just to give an idea of how things are being run around this whole thing. But what BP's also been effective at doing is putting a government face to what's actually happening, making it look like, well, it's Obama's decision to go ahead and open the Gulf back up. It's actually the Coast Guard who's making the decisions about whether or not to use the dispersant, when in reality, of course, it's pretty clear who's calling the shots.
I was going to ask a different question, too, because what we have seen now is what we are looking right at. The facts are coming in. But isn't there a mysterious question as to, with all these evil dispersants and with the lowering of the oil plumes themselves into lower levels of the water, isn't there some giant possibility of suddenly an eruption of totally new oil plumes? Does that scare you? I mean, I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Well, the thing is, the scientists studying this that I mentioned earlier, they all say, one thing they say that's very... they have in common is that, you know, this is a giant experiment. Never before has there been this much dispersants used in one place ever. Never before have they been used in this depth, and certainly not on this amount of oil. I mean, if we look at, you know, I think the flow rate that the government ended up deciding was the average daily flow rate was something like 67,000 barrels a day. But then we have independent scientists so I've seen estimates as high as 140,000 a day. And if we go with, like, Ira Leifer's estimates, another scientist who studies this, we're talking about 100,000 a day, which would be, that means 34 Exxon Valdez worth of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, coupled with almost 2 million gallons of dispersants that they admit to. We know it's a higher number than that, but that's a lot. And that it's formed these plumes, and we already know one of the University of South Florida groups actually just did another trip out there and did soil sample testing in giant areas all around the wellhead. And a lot of the oil has been sunk all the way down to the ocean floor. And so they're literally looking at just giant swaths where deep sea corals, other types of life down there are just annihilated, where literally it's soaked down into the mud. It's going to be there for decades. In that cold, at that depth, it's not going to go anywhere. Other things they're finding with the plumes is that Samantha Joyce said in the last month that she estimates some of these plumes could last for decades. Because, again, we're talking about plumes that are down in, you know, between 4 and 2,000 feet of water, totally dark, very, very cold temperatures that are basically there and not moving around so much at that depth. So they don't really know, like, what is going to happen to them. Will they eventually leave the Gulf? How long will they last? And she said, you know, she estimated actually it's not out of the realm of possibility to say that they could last for a decade or even longer. And so we just don't know. And I think, in a way, that's one of the creepiest parts of this whole situation. And the same thing can be said about the longer-term impact on the folks living along the Gulf. What's going to happen to them? What's going to happen to the 3-year-old kid that already has these chemicals in his blood? You know, and that's one of the scarier parts of it.
You mentioned a Gulf restoration group. Can it be restored? I mean, based on what you're saying now, I mean, is it beyond restoration, or what are their hopes or plans for restoring it, and how long will it take? Are those all unknowns?
That's another really important question, and, you know, it's kind of a grim answer. Aaron Viles is the guy, the highest up guy at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans that I spoke with, and he's basically their public policy coordinator. And he said that even before this disaster started on April 20, he said that the Gulf of Mexico is basically, the way he looks at it, and I've heard other scientists refer to it this way as well. He said the Gulf of Mexico, and especially our region in Louisiana, parts of Alabama, and certainly the eastern parts of Texas, he calls it an energy sacrifice zone, that it's a given that the oil industry is here, that they're going to suck this area dry of oil until there's nothing left, damn the consequences, and that, you know, if it means blowouts like this and it means environmental disasters and human disasters, then that's just the price of, you know, the consequences of oil, basically. And he literally referred to it as the guy who, you know, the head of the GRN office in New Orleans said, this is basically an energy sacrifice zone. And, you know, if they did all the work necessary to do rehabilitation and cleanup and restoration, that would be to get it back, the Gulf back to April 19. And again, that's why I give these statistics of, you know, 40,000 miles of pipelines, 50,000 natural gas and oil wells that have been drilled into the Gulf of Mexico, many of these completely abandoned and rusted and leaking as we speak. So it's a really grim situation. I mean, that whole area. I mean, I'm from Houston originally, and I spent a lot of my youth down in Galveston, and we would go down, you know, Galveston Bay, of course, right up against Texas City, Commerce City. Of course, BP has a refinery there, and you know, it's basically a Texas version of Chemical Alley, where all, you know, something like 20% of the country's oil is refined there, and it's right up against Galveston Bay. But back when I was a kid, we used to go down there and go fishing and shrimping and literally feed ourselves for the weekend out of what we caught in Galveston Bay. And I went down there about 11 years ago, and we tried to do the same thing, and we couldn't catch one thing. I mean, you know, so it's a well-known fact that there's big areas of dead zones now, you know, totally oxygen-depleted dead zones, chemical-laced areas in Galveston Bay, off the coast of Louisiana, at the mouth of the Mississippi, because of this type of industry. And, of course, another product of this disaster, the plumes automatically create, again, these oxygen-depleted dead zones. So they were already very large. Now, of course, they're going to be larger. So, it's grim. I mean, what would have to happen is basically a revolution in policy to where, you know, we can't keep doing this kind of drilling. We can't afford another disaster like this. But until we basically have a real tectonic shift in government and how things are being run in this country, it's full steam ahead. And it's already been set by the oil industry themselves in the wake of this that it's basically standard operating procedure. If there is another disaster, we use Corexit 9500 in mass quantities. We use 9527. We do the booming thing for the media, and that's just how we're going to handle it. And meanwhile, of course, you know, they're exploring in deeper areas, and not just in the United States, but around the world. And I think it just really underscores, this is kind of pie-in-the-sky stuff, but the reality is it just underscores we have to get off this oil-based economy, you know, because it's literally going to kill us if we don't. And I think that's obviously the big message that we take home from the BP disaster.
We'll do two more, Dar. We'll do one more.
Okay.
I just want to make a comment, Dar. I see parallels with the southern coal fields. The life expectancy that's been lowered down there, the cancers that are rampant. That's an energy sacrifice area. Nobody cares about our miners and their communities. There's a real parallel there.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's all the same war. And just, I mean, I'm no expert on fracking or, you know, mountaintop mining and in the coal industry, but just the bits I've read and spoken with people about, it really is all the same war. And I think it's going to all take the same types of tectonic shifts that have to happen. And again, I'm not trying to paint a rosy, you know, an almost impossible situation, a rosy color, but the one of the inspiring things that we saw down in the Gulf is that there's no political divide down there. The people that are directly affected, the fishermen, the folks in the tourist industry, you know, across the entire political spectrum, we were hanging out with people that, you know, there's no way politically we should have ever been in the same room, and that stuff never even came up. It was all about, what are we going to do? Okay, you're doing this, I'm doing this, you're doing this, you need to talk to this person. And, you know, people down there, where they was fully clear, we're reporting for Al Jazeera, which of course has this, you know, has been branded as a, you know, terrorist channel or something, which is totally insane. But, you know, they understood, and we were being praised regularly by these like hardcore right wing shrimpers in Mississippi, like thanking us that Al Jazeera was there because we were the only big media staying on the story. And I mean, that was just an example of how, you know, any of these kind of ridiculous political divisions are, you know, we don't have time to bicker about what your favorite color is when we're all in the same lifeboat together. We have to figure out how we're going to get through this and who's going to do what if we're going to make it. And that's what's happening down in the Gulf. And I think that, you know, I mean, the silver lining to this whole crisis is, I think that slowly but surely, that kind of understanding is what's starting to kind of happen across the country, is that, you know, these things that are thrown at the population from the powers that be to divide us and keep us each other's throats and all of this to keep us from unifying, those are becoming less effective. And I think people are starting to get that.
And if we can get corporate money out of the elections and get public financed elections, that will save us. I don't know how I don't know how we're going to do it, folks. Dar, thank you so much for coming. It's been an incredible presentation. Thanks again.
Thanks.
We really appreciate it. Dar Shamal.